let's go on an adventure back to the early 1900s in the stunningly beautiful and brutally unforgiving mountains of Colorado, where in sub-zero weather, poor immigrant miners extract the world's most precious marble for monuments to greatness and to Confederate hate, where the budget for the wealthy mine owners' strawberries is more than workers' pay, and a local newspaper run by women reports on such injustices. Recently freed slaves move out to start their own community, and a French-Canadian teen from Vermont moves in and meets union activist Mother Jones. There was such a town, Marble, Colorado, but author Kate Manning renames it Moonstone in her sweeping new novel, Gilded Mountain, which was inspired by an old family photograph. Kate, start there. Describe it.
Yeah, it's a long sepia-tinted panorama from 1915. You know, about 100 people standing in front of a mountain range, and it's entitled National Retail Monument Dealers at Marble, Colorado. And I found it in my parents' attic probably 15, 20 years ago. And I brought it to my dad, and I said, hey, who are these people, and what do we have to do with Colorado? And he said, I don't know. I think one of them is my grandfather, my great-grandfather. And he said, well, I think he had something to do with quarrying the marble for the Lincoln Memorial. So I kind of pictured a guy with a pickaxe, to be honest. But then I spelunked around and did some more research about 10 years ago, and lo and behold, the ancestor was the president of the company. I started investigating the story for my dad, and when I found some earlier history from the early 1900s, I was just blown away. I didn't really want to tell my ancestor's story. I wanted to get a wider perspective.
Well, frankly, the people who represent your ancestors don't come off very well. the owners of this mining company. Set the scene for us. You have these poor families like Sylvie Pelletier, who's moved with her mother and younger brothers to join their dad, who's a miner, living in these tents in this sub-zero weather. You also have a newspaper involved. I'm looking again at your acknowledgments. It looks like you turned to real newspapers. The Marble Booster from 1911 to 1915. The Marble City Times.
Yes. What really sparked my imagination was this very fearless newspaper editor named Sylvia Smith. And I named Sylvie after her because I really admired her tenacity. She was really fearless. She owned a newspaper in this tiny town of 1,000 people, and she was pro-labor, she was pro-women's suffrage in a time when women did not have the vote, except in Colorado. But she wrote quite critically about the Marble Company, and for that, she suffered severe consequences. At the same time, there was another, a rival paper in the town called The Booster, which was run by the company, and it published very folksy stories about litters of kittens and Halloween costume contests, a lot of articles about the rosy prospects for investing in the marble business. And so I wanted there to be a rivalry like that one in the novel. And young Sylvie is apprenticed to an editor like the real one in the real town. And through that, she begins to see the world with different eyes, and she begins to understand that the way you see the world depends on who's telling you the story.
Right. And so you have in your book the Moonstone City Record, and one of the headlines there, the Paget Company, which was the company that ran the town, wins lucrative contract $100,000 worth of stone for Confederate monument in nation's capital. And then this intrepid editor tags at the bottom, bonus reward, the Moonstone City Record offers a $100 prize to anyone who can produce a former slave willing to testify to those alleged happy and carefree days. Did you see writing like that in the newspapers of the time?
I certainly did. You know, W.E.B. Du Bois and many others were very active in trying to prevent something called the Loyal Slave Monument. So I was borrowing and pulling strands from other newspapers of the day.
Well, I would turn every page and say, is this true? And we Googled some of it, and there was a town called Deerfield that was founded by recently freed slaves. It's now a ghost town.
Yes, it is. And you know, here were people who were African Americans who were striving and dreaming of a utopian place where they could be free, where they could make their own lives. And so followers of Booker T. Washington, who was a leading intellectual of the day, along with W.E.B. Du Bois, wanted people to go and make their own way. And so a guy in Denver named Toussaint Jackson founded this town, Deerfield, and they really made a go of it for 30 years until the Dust Bowl came and the railroad didn't go through, and maybe that was intentional, I'm not sure. So yeah, Deerfield is the ghost town now, and historians in Colorado are trying to preserve it.
Right. Again, your protagonist, Sylvie Peltier, comes across Mother Jones.
She spent a great deal of time in Colorado. She was a fierce labor leader. You know, workers really loved this woman that they called Mother, and she called them her boys. You know, she had much more savory terms for the industrialists, wealthy industrialists that she went up against. She called them, you know, blood-sucking leeches, and she called the politicians in their pockets lapdogs. She nicknamed politicians. She called Governor Glasscock of Colorado. She called him Crystal Peter, so I couldn't really resist her. I couldn't resist her salty language or her force. She was amazing. But I'll tell you, as I was researching, I discovered that my ancestor, the guy that I found in the picture, was actually a strike breaker. He was a union buster. You know, I've been in a union myself, and workers are really struggling to get a decent, fair living wage. And so I wanted to grapple with that legacy. And pretty much most of what Mother Jones says in the text of the fiction, she really said.
Well, I'm looking again at the acknowledgments at the reading that you did for this. And there's Mother Jones, The Most Dangerous Woman in America by Elliot J. Gorn. Mother Jones Speaks, Philip S. Foner. A Lady's Life in the Rocky Mountains by Isabella Bird. The Colorado Fuel and Iron Company magazine, Marble, Colorado. It just feels so real.
Yeah, I hope so. You know, I quote E.L. Doctorow a lot when I'm thinking about this book. He said, an historian will tell you what happened, but a novelist will tell you how it felt.
Hmm. What about being in the mountains?
I feel like in many ways you use what you know. I know what it is to be cold. I don't know what it is to be that cold. But yeah, I think in a lot of ways writing fiction is somewhat like acting, that you immerse yourself in the skin of whichever character you're writing in the moment. So the mountains are stunning. They're jaw-droppingly beautiful. And you just have to, I think, put yourself in the shoes of your people and walk with them if you can.
Yeah. A flap of tar paper served as the door to a lean-to room just big enough for a shuck mattress, a washstand. We thawed our fingers, the baby's toes, with our breath. Our hands and feet itched and burned, turned the bright red of raw meat. Mama found frozen bread in the cupboard, a can of oysters, a can of peas, and handed them to me with a tin punch.
Yeah, I rely a lot on images. So I found quite a few images of quarry towns, shacks balanced on the edge of a crevasse. They really do have holes in between the slats. And I read memoirs of women like A Lady's Life in the Rocky Mountains, and Tomboy Bride is another great one, about how women made lives in this man's world.
Again, the description, strips of canvas and pages from the Phrenological Journal covered the walls, newspapers in the cracks. What's the Phrenological Journal?
Well, have you ever seen one of those heads with moods of the mind mapped out? Like, I actually have one in my office.
Oh, right.
So your intuitive properties and your propensity for calculation or language or miracles or whatever. And they really believe that areas of the brain corresponded to these human traits. And so there was a journal, and it was popular reading in those days, and I just thought that would be funny.
And just the French-Canadian part of this, her dad, the miner who's been living here ahead of them, says it's the Cathedral of God. He'd traveled with the circus, which is why he could juggle, why he could hang off a scaffold with a chisel and swallow flames. He'd run with the Iroquois, which is why he could see in the dark and nest in the trees. My father lived in a tent all through the winter. Goldfinches nested in his beard. He spoke Canadian French. His English was American. He could walk on his hands.
I knew that a lot of quarry workers came from Quebec to Vermont. I also thought it'd be fun to play with the Quebecois French. And the past is present. It tells us a lot about how we got where we are today. There's, you know, this wealth gap. There are labor struggles. There are news wars. There are arguments about monuments. And you know, this could be called, you know, Downton Abbey set in the Rocky Mountains.
Yes.
But yeah, I just hope readers will find new things and spark thought.
I'm just curious, how does your dad feel about that? This was his grandfather.
You know, he didn't know. I went out to Colorado right after he died.
Oh.
And sometimes it takes a generation or two for people to take an interest in the past. You know, we all know our stories, and we don't think it's necessary to write, you know, who that was on the back of the photograph.
Right.
You know.
Right.
But I think it's important to do it.
Well, yeah, the daughter who's a journalist and an author is the one that finds out. That is Kate Manning. Her book is Gilded Mountain. Kate, thank you so much for talking to us about it.
Oh, Robin, it was a real pleasure. Thank you for having me here.